This year, as a group, we are reading through the books of Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel. And by the time we get to this particular chapter, what we're going to be looking at this morning, chapter 22, David's life really has completely bottomed out by this point in time. In his flight from Saul's angry sword, he has lost his position in the palace. He has lost his home. He's lost his wife in the form of Michal, his spiritual mentor in the form of Samuel, and his closest friend in the form of Jonathan. When chapter 21 comes to an end, we find that there's a sense in which he's also lost his self-respect. We see David with saliva dribbling down his beard. He has been reduced to scribbling on a Philistine gate in, of all places, the city of Gath, the home of Goliath. He becomes aware that his identity is known to the enemy, and so he pretends to be a madman. And when you get to chapter 22, he has fled from the city of Gath and again goes on the run. And as that chapter opens, we're told that so David departed from there and escaped to the cave at Adullam. He is a man who has seemingly no security, no consistent supply of food, no real friends, and from at least human appearances, no hope. When we come to that chapter, it is one of the lowest points in all of David's life. And he attests to that in this particular psalm. Look at chapter 142. You'll notice in the superscription that it is a maskil of David when he was in the cave, a prayer. I cry aloud with my voice to the Lord. I make supplication with my voice to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before Him. I declare my trouble before Him. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, You knew my path in the way where I walk. They have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see, for there is no one who regards me. There is no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. Can you sense something of the loneliness in David's words here? Can you connect with the despair that he experiences in the dampness of that cave? Can you see something of the depth to which he has sunk emotionally? In the first four verses, it is as though David's perspective is that he has nothing left. And we'd be hard-pressed to find a sadder statement in the Scriptures than verse 4. The idea of looking to the right is meaningful. That's where a friend would be, a defender would be. But there is no one from whom he can expect help. He is left without all hope, it seems. And we find in those first four verses that just because you are a man or a woman who is after God's own heart does not mean that you will be immune to despair and discouragement, that it is in the dampness of a cave that we find David in an unexpected place emotionally. He feels alone and abandoned. He is overwhelmed with despair and discouragement. But he's not the first of God's faithful to find himself in such a place, and he certainly won't be the last. Joseph, of course, is in prison in Egypt. The Israelites are in bondage also in the land of Egypt. Daniel will be in a lion's den, Joan in the belly of a fish. Paul will be shipwrecked on an island. And yet oftentimes, as it is in David's experience and perhaps yours, certainly in mine, that it's when you feel that you're at the bottom that you are equipped perhaps to see the most clearly, because the only way to look is up. And in the second half of the psalm, it's clear that in spite of his despair, David has not lost sight of his God. And so he cries out to him for deliverance. He clings to him in trust. Verse 5, I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, You are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring my soul out of prison so that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. I think at this moment in time, it would have been difficult to convince David of the of prosperity theology, the health and wealth gospel. His walk, at least in the last couple of chapters of 1 Samuel, has not been a case of him simply stepping from one fluffy cloud to the next. you can glamorize a lot of things, but a cavern is not one of them. And it is here, make your way if you would over to 1 Samuel chapter 22. It is here in the cave at Adullam that David seeks refuge. And by the way, that's what Adullam means, refuge. It's an area that's believed to be close to Bethlehem. David may have known it from his wandering with the sheep while he was a boy. And it is here in the cave of Adullam that David is going to receive further training, further character building. It will, he will learn to submit to greater wisdom than his own. And it takes place in, of all places, a cave. When people get to a very low point, they oftentimes want to throw in the towel, perhaps even to the point of taking their own life. But God's grace allows David to redirect his life. Because the cave will not only serve as an ideal hiding place for David, but it is here that David will be able to have his faith rebuilt, that he will be shaped and molded for greater use as a leader of men. Typically, despair likes to be alone. Despair seldom, if ever, likes company. When we're feeling down, we just want to be left alone. And yet what we are about to see here is that David in his despair will have the weight of that burden spread among one group of people who loved him and a second group of people who needed him. We're introduced to the first group in verse 1, and that's his family. So David departed from there, that is in the previous chapter, the city of Gath. And he escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. It hasn't been that many chapters prior to this that David's family didn't hardly pay any attention to him, or they resented him. For example, when Samuel came to the house of Jesse in chapter 16 with the objective of anointing the next king of Israel, he goes through all of the sons of Jesse until he runs out of sons and he says, "Do you have another one?" David is almost forgotten by his father. He's out tending the sheep. And then in chapter 17, when Saul and his army are gathered against the Philistines and they are being taunted by Goliath, the champion of the Philistines, it is David who comes to the camp of Saul's army, and it's there that his oldest brother Eliab's anger burns against David to the extent that he slanders his younger brother. He insinuates that David is irresponsible. He maligns David's motive for being there. You just want to see a train wreck. You got to read the Hebrew to get that out of that. But it's here at Adullam that when David is crushed in spirit, when there is no crutches to lean on, that his family comes to him. You'll notice he doesn't call for them. He doesn't send for them. They find out where he is, and they go to him. Remember that David is an outlaw in the king's court. He is a fugitive from Saul's wrath. And here he is dwelling alone in a cave. And it's there that those who love him are willing to stand beside this one who is so intensely hated by the one man who is in a position of authority, Saul. And it's for good reason that they leave and come to David, for if Saul is willing to massacre an entire town of priests because of some imagined connection to David, then what would he be willing to do to members of David's family who have an actual connection to this alleged renegade? But while there may have been an aspect here of fearing Saul's reprisals, there's also great comfort seen in the fact that their love and their loyalty to David are unaffected by the outward circumstances in which David finds himself. It was Arthur Pink who said that where the heart is genuinely knit to another, a change of fortunes will not produce a change of affections. In the eyes of some, perhaps even many in Israel, David is perceived as a disgraced troublemaker. But not in the minds of those who really knew him, and certainly not in the minds of those who cared for him. And often, even in our own experience, it is during times of difficulty and trouble that we find out who our true friends really are, those who genuinely love us. though there was a time when David's father didn't even give a thought of his youngest son until he had no sons left to choose from, when his oldest brother accused him of ulterior motives and prideful positioning, it's when David is hurting and humbled that his family comes to him. But notice in verse 2, because there's a second group who come, not just the family members that David knows, but a group of people that he doesn't know. Verse 2. Everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And he became captain over them. Now, there were about 400 men with him. I understand that David has not placed an ad in the Israelite Times. He's not gone looking for these people. He's not communicated his need to anyone except to God, as we saw in Psalm 142. And yet here we see something of what God does. The writer responds by giving us three categories of individuals who gather themselves to David. There are the distressed, comes from a Hebrew word that means to be under pressure or under stress. There are the debtors, the people who owed creditors and who lacked the means to repay. And then there are the discontented, a word that means to be in bitterness of soul, to have been wronged or mistreated. And what these categories of people imply to us is that not everything under the king's reign has been wonderful. And Samuel predicted that, didn't he, all the way back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, that understand that when you have a king, he is going to use you and he is going to tax you and he may even wrong you. And here in their deep need, they come to David and they see him as being a source of hope. These are not the rich and the powerful. These are not the influential model citizens of Israel. These are the down and outers. These are the restless and the rebellious. They too have been misunderstood and maligned and mistreated. And they seek out David in this cavern and David's escape hatch. If there was a desire to be alone, it's pretty much shot here, isn't it? Because that cave becomes a magnet for those who are experiencing some of the same emotions that David is. They hear about his whereabouts and they quickly make their way to Adullam. And you'll notice that upon their arrival, David doesn't run them off. David doesn't dismiss them or run from them. Instead, he realizes their needs, he accepts their following, and he begins the task of transforming this group of 400 misfits, if you will, into a loyal and effective group of fighting men. What an incredible picture of how God works. That here is David feeling alone and discouraged in a cave, that no one cares for his soul. And God turns that same cave that nobody saw into a camp of raw recruits that nobody knew. Previously, David had felt as though nobody cared for his soul, that there was no one to his right. And now he's got his family members to his right, and he's got 400 men that he will develop into a nucleus of an army who will help him and defend him, and men who will even die for him. We're not told why these particular groups of people came searching for David. We're not told that they saw him as Israel's rightful leader, or that they believed that he had somehow earned the right to rule over them. What is important for us to see is not what we're not told, but to understand that these were men who didn't just identify with David, they decided for David. They willingly submitted themselves to this one who now became their new captain. It's one thing to say you believe something to be true and right. It's something different to risk your life for what you say is true and right. To openly take a stand. Understand that siding with David, these men simultaneously now make themselves the enemy of the one who rules the land of Israel. There is nothing commendable that is said about them except their desperate need. And yet these men will not only become some of David's mighty men, but some of them will occupy an official capacity when David actually takes the throne of king. It's very similar to Jephthah that we see in the book of Judges, where David takes this band of misfits, like Jephthah took his band of misfits, Men who lacked direction, who lacked wealth, who perhaps even lacked character, and he transforms them that will into tools that will be useful for the Lord's cause. Here at Adullam, there is a company of men who will, with the help of David, get their act together. They may have been rebels and mavericks before, but they will now learn and develop incredible discipline that will be beneficial in the battles that lie ahead. These distressed and indebted and discontented, this mob will be honed by David's leadership skills, and they will be shaped by David's marvelous example of what a man of God genuinely looks like. Isn't it amazing that during one of the darkest periods of David's life, God uses a cavern of all things to provide David not only with purpose and direction, but he gives him 400 men who need to be equipped, who themselves are weakened by despair, and he will turn them into effective warriors. What we see in the first two verses is that David will move quickly from fear to faith. As we saw in Psalm 142, David, as at one of his lowest points, he feels alone and overwhelmed. He believes there is no one who is concerned for him. And in the midst of his despair, he cries out to God for deliverance. And this is how God answers his prayer. With his family and with 400 down and outers. Turn from 1 Samuel. Look, if you will, at Psalm 57. Look at Psalm 57, if you will. Because this psalm also, according to the superscription, is written during David's cave experience. Psalm 57, beginning in verse 1. You'll notice that this is also a mitcham of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. And he writes this time, "Be gracious to me, O God, be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in you. And in the shadow of your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. I will cry to God Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He reproaches him who tramples upon me. God will send forth his loving kindness and his truth. My soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue is a sharp sword." You have to wonder, is he talking about the 400 men there that came at this point in time? "Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have dug a pit before me. They themselves have fallen into the midst of it. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing, yes, I will sing praises. Awake, my glory. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your loving kindness is great to the heavens and your truth to the clouds. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth." That's a wonderful example of the confidence of a steadfast man. That in spite of being surrounded by vicious enemies, he, in his pain, he reaches out to God. He prays that God would meet his needs as a result of God's faithful love. He trusts in God's power and God's ability to save him, and he does it so that God will be glorified, exalted as a result. In Psalm 142, David has his eyes more upon himself. Here, his eyes are raised to look above him, and we see here a declaration of dependence, if you will. Look at Psalm 34, another psalm written during this time in David's life. Psalm 34. In Psalm 34, the superscription identifies it as a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. An interesting thing there is he was actually with Achish, the king of Gath, but there's a reference here to Abimelech. And it reminds us of the time when of Abraham and Isaac and the struggles that they had when they lied about their wives or didn't tell the whole truth about their wives. And God saw them through when they felt that, like their lives were threatened. Verse 1, picking up, he says, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make its boast in the Lord. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and he delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant, and their faces will never be ashamed. This poor man cried out, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who take refuge in Him. Oh, fear the Lord, you His saints, for to those who fear Him there is no want. The young lions do not lack and suffer hunger, but they who seek the Lord shall not be in want of any good thing. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves length of days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and His ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The righteous cry, and the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted, and He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. You remember that's quoted in reference to Jesus in the Gospel of John. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of His servants, and none of those who take refuge in Him will be condemned. This psalm actually has an alphabetic construction to it, and its one timeless statement throughout the psalm is pretty much that God is good. Not just making a moral statement, but rather a relational proclamation. Its emphasis in the psalm is that God's eyes and God's ears are always toward those who are His people. That when we are in need, God is nearby. That when we face terrors and troubles and we cry out, that God delivers and He protects. And that the wicked will have just the opposite experience of that. Some modern messages, and then we'll wrap up our study this morning. The first one is that we see in all of these texts the keys to altering our own perspective. And the first one is that we need to be open to admitting our own needs. In Psalm 142, we see David there bowed with his face to the ground, if you will. And in those seven verses of Psalm 142, there's no cover-up, there's no attempt to just sort of fake his way through it, there's no hypocrisy, no pretense. David is down and he readily makes that known to the Lord. And the Lord makes it known to us. At times we get the idea that if we're struggling, that we need to just keep it under wraps. That if we're feeling despairing and discouraged and down, that we need to keep that from other people for fear of what they might say or think about us. And David says, no, no, no. The key to altering your perspective is being open to admitting that. Bruce Larson, in some of his writings, said that the neighborhood bar is possibly the best counterfeit there is to the fellowship Christ wants in His church. It is an imitation, dispensing liquor instead of grace, escape rather than reality. But it is a permissible, accepting, and inclusive fellowship. The bar flourishes not because most people are alcoholics, but because God has put into the human heart the desire to know and to be known, to love and to be loved. And so many seek a counterfeit at the price of a few beers. With all my heart, I believe that Christ wants His church to be a fellowship where people can come in and say, I am sunk, I am beat. I've had it. We all need a place of refuge, a cave, a cavern, if you will, when we're hurting. A place where people not only understand, but who offer encouragement and comfort. When you're despairing about something, you don't need critics. What you need is shelter. What you need is a place to heal. What you need is hope. And certainly, I understand something of our trepidation to be open. I think there's some justification to that. People don't see us, or they change their view of us when they hear that we're struggling with something. But what David shows us is that it's certainly never justified when we're dealing with God, that we can be completely open and admit our needs to Him, as David was in Psalm 142. But there's another step that we see in David's life too, isn't it? And that is to be honest, ask for help. And we see that in Psalm 57, that in our culture that promotes individuality and independence and self-sufficiency, that today, you know, being able to do it all on your own, that's the accepted thing. But when you admit weakness, you also recognize your need to have help. And David maybe felt the need to go at it alone for a while, but eventually in the cave at Adullam, he comes to his senses and he seeks out the only one who is in a position to lend him aid. And so in Psalm 142, we see David bowed on his face to the ground in prayer. We find in Psalm 57, David on his knees. And then in Psalm 34, what we find is David on his feet. To be humble in developing a teachable spirit. He now has come to the place where he sees that in all of the circumstances in life, even the most difficult ones, that David could or that God could provide for David, that God not only would deliver David, but that God delighted in doing that. And how did God do it? He provided a group of followers for David that nobody saw and nobody cared about. And yet, as a result of David's training and David's influence, they will become a skillful army of courageous fighters. And it all transpires within the rock walls of a cavern at Adullam, that David's song of despair is transformed into a plea of trust and into a proclamation of determination. Sadly, there are a lot of Christians today who are simply content to move from one cavern to the next, without ever learning the lessons that God is trying to teach them in that particular cave experience. Christianity isn't always about soaring on the clouds, is it? It's not about stepping from one fluffy white pillow-like cloud to the next. Sometimes it's discouraging. Sometimes it brings despair. Sometimes we feel alone in a dark, damp cavern. And yet the caverns are part of the process, aren't they? Of molding and shaping us into the people that God ultimately wants for us to be. But we also see in this section of David's life the shadows of Jesus. David, remember, is the anointed one. And yet he is hated and he is envied by the one who is the competition for the throne and those who side with David's opponent. And there's a parallel here in that Jesus claimed to be the king, and yet he is hated by his competitor, Satan. And Satan will pull out all of the stops to continue his reign in the hearts of men. Jesus is also hated by those who are of their father, the devil, the religious leaders who despised and envied the connection that Jesus had with his father and with the common people. Before taking the throne, David is a homeless outcast, and later Jesus will say that to his followers that the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, Luke 9 and verse 58. And those who come to David and those who come to Christ are also similar, aren't they? There's no mention anywhere that it was the captains of Saul's army or the government officials or the princes or men of state who came to Adullam. It's instead those people would be content to stay where they were. It's the down and outers. It's the hurting. It's the ones who recognize their need. It's the indebted. It's the discontented. Those are the ones who in both cases come to David and also who come to Jesus. They seek a new king in hopes that he could bring relief to the things that they were suffering. And then there's a final parallel, and that is that there's a decision that needed to be made between the two camps. And it was an all or nothing decision. When these 400 men turned their back on Saul and his kingdom, understand, there was no going back. These men could no more serve both Saul and David than you and I today can serve Satan and Christ at the same time. And so as we close this morning, we come to a point of decision. Which one will you choose? Because you can't serve both. Understand that when you turn your back on one, you become an opponent of the other. James tells us in chapter 4 and verse 4 of his epistle that if we make ourselves a friend of the world, we become an enemy of God. And it's also true, if we become a friend of God, we become an enemy to the world. This morning, which one will you choose? Because you can only follow one. We hope this morning you will choose Jesus. That you will come to Him and that you will admit your need, that you will understand that He has the power and the authority to deliver you from your need in regard to sin or other things that are going on. And that He promises renewal. He is a King who is worthy of being followed and who can provide us with the things that we hope for. Do you need to come to Him this morning? No better time to obey the gospel than now. It's the time we know that we have. And so won't you choose this morning to serve Jesus Christ and put Him on as we close our service, our sermon this morning. Come right now while together we stand and sing.